KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego's Art Power, presenting Good Writing, an evening with Anne Lamott and Neil Allen at the Balboa Theater on April 1. Tickets at artpower.ucsd.edu.
Hey there, San Diego. It's time for KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. The City Council of National City rejected a proposed biofuel plant this week over environmental concerns. How residents and environmental groups rallied to reject it in a community that's long felt pollution's effects. Then, The Finest, KPBS's arts and culture podcast, wraps up their first season of episodes. The team behind it shares some of their favorite moments. And we check in on a busy week in California politics. That's ahead on KPBS Roundtable. It's been a busy week in California politics. The state's voters approved Proposition 50 to redraw congressional maps to favor Democrats. Now a group of California Republicans have filed a lawsuit challenging that measure, but that's not all that's been happening. Longtime Congresswoman and former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, announced her plans to retire from Congress in January. We wanted to take a few minutes to take stock of a busy week in politics, and here to help us do that is Alexi Kossoff. He's the Washington, D.C. correspondent with the San Francisco Chronicle. Alexi, welcome back to Roundtable.
Thanks for having me on.
So I was looking, the last time we spoke, you joined us back in August when Proposition 50 was really just starting to take shape. I'm wondering if you can reflect back on how we got here this week from those early days of when this measure started to take hold.
I still can barely believe it, honestly, because over the summer when the idea of Proposition 50 was first floated, it seemed like such a long shot, you know, maybe even a political fantasy. But the momentum really very quickly came together. Lawmakers in Sacramento fell behind Gavin Newsom's plan to put this on the ballot to, you know, take power away temporarily from California's Independent Redistricting Commission and essentially fight back against Trump. That's the message that they put out there. And the Democrats got behind it. California voters got behind it. And they now have an overwhelming victory on their hands, which is really sort of stunning, the distance that we've come in just those 3 months.
Yeah, it has traveled fast, seems like. So what do you think Prop 50 success means for, you know, other states, either blue or red states, in redistricting efforts? Because we're seeing this kind of happen in other places as well, obviously.
Absolutely. I would say it's been interesting this week as I've been reporting on that. Democratic states really seem to be gaining momentum to redistrict, while Republican states are sort of losing momentum right now to redistrict. There was sort of this flurry of energy this summer, and a couple of Republican states moved very quickly, and Democratic states were trying to assess their options. It wasn't as easy for them because so many of them have adopted these independent commissions. But with the success of Prop 50, we've seen Virginia just in the past 2 weeks start moving toward a similar ballot measure that they could put on the ballot next year to try and overturn temporarily their independent redistricting commission and add more Democratic seats. And pressure is growing on states now like Maryland and Illinois to also act and add more seats for Democrats. So there's, you know, a lot of pressure and activity there, whereas the Republican states that haven't acted yet seem to kind of be digging in their heels. And it's not as clear much how many more seats Republicans will be able to gain through traditional redistricting.
Shifting gears now, Nancy Pelosi, longtime California congresswoman from California, she became the first woman Speaker of the House. She announced her resignation this week. I'm wondering if you can reflect on her legacy, but also, you know, what her retirement means for the future of the Democratic Party here in California.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a huge deal, not necessarily unexpected. There were a lot of signals coming that she might retire at the end of this term. But it is a momentous, you know, announcement for California because, you know, not only did Nancy Pelosi serve 4 decades in Congress, she was the leader of the Democrats for two of those decades. And she was able to accomplish a lot for California through that position of power, bringing resources back to the state, making sure the priorities of the state were, you know, heard in national legislation, in appropriations, and also kind of sharing the values of California and exporting those nationally through the Democratic Party agenda. So it's a huge sort of loss symbolically and, you know, just materially for California. But, you know, there will be some of her kind of mentees who are rising up through the ranks in Washington that will hopefully be able to step up and kind of fill that void a bit for the state.
You mentioned Washington there, and, you know, we need to point out, you know, previously we talked to you from Sacramento, but you recently made the move to cover national politics in Washington. And I'm just curious, you know, how is covering national politics there different from all those years you spent in California's capital, Sacramento?
Well, I mean, it's an exciting change to make, and I'm certainly glad to be doing it here with an eye still on California. My hope is, you know, there's so few reporters left here in Washington, D.C. who are covering California specifically. So I'm excited to be bringing coverage that really digs into the, you know, what's meaningful for the state here in the national sphere. But I would say the biggest change I've noticed so far is just the sheer scale of everything compared to the Capitol in Sacramento. I mean, it's so much bigger. There's so many more people. I've gotten lost in the basement so many times. So definitely just a few weeks in and figuring out my bearings for sure.
Well, and we'll check back in with you to see how you're doing in the coming months. I'm sure you'll find your way around those basements and, you know, coming up. Alexi Kossoff is the Washington, D.C. correspondent with the San Francisco Chronicle. Alexi, thanks so much for being here, and we'll talk again soon, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
After the break, National City rejected a proposed biofuel project this week over concerns of pollution. That's ahead on Roundtable.
KPBS On Demand is supported by UC San Diego's Art Power, co-presenting Mayrig with Art of Elan on January 29th at The Loft. Tickets at artpower.ucsd.edu.
Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. In National City this week, a unanimous vote to reject a depot widely criticized for potential health impacts. Dozens of community members spoke out against it, in a neighborhood already impacted by industrial pollution. Joining me with the story is Corey Suzuki. He covers San Diego South Bay for KPBS. And also, Philip Salata is here. He's environment and energy reporter with iNewsSource. I want to welcome you both back to the roundtable. Corey, let's talk about the fuel depot at the center of this vote. It would have been a hub for biofuels. What exactly does that mean?
Yes, that's right, Andrew. The hub... The depot itself would have been a hub for regional distribution of biofuels, as you said. Biofuels are cleaner alternatives to diesel and gas. And the idea behind this depot, the company behind it, argued that it would cut the region's emissions by making it easier to distribute these fuels across San Diego County. But like you said, the project faced opposition from hundreds of residents, local school officials, environmental advocates, because it would rely on diesel-burning trucks and trains to transport that fuel. So even though it was focused on these cleaner alternatives, it would still be bringing pollution to this part of the city.
Yeah, and that's kind of an interesting kind of juxtaposition there, because you're right. This biofuel is meant to improve the environment, but it's still the transportation adds these, you know, uses these diesel forms of transportation, right, Philip? Can you talk about why the potential location here for this project was so controversial?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is located in an area that is actually tucked in right in a residential area, and there's an elementary school there as well, and also St. Anthony de Padua Church. So it's really, it's within,
a rock's
throw,
area,
right, a rock's throw of a lot of children coming through the area as well. And it also is supposed to run 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. And many of these trucks going through the neighborhood at critical hours when people would be out and experiencing life in the neighborhood. I also want to say that, right, the idea was to, behind the station, to cut overall emissions in California and reach state goals. But that would also concentrate these diesel emissions in this neighborhood, in an area that's been designated by the state as particularly impacted by industrial pollution.
Yeah, and we want to kind of dig more into that. But Corey, I'm first wondering if you can tell us more about what the city council decided on Tuesday and why they ultimately voted against the project.
Yeah, and this has been kind of a weeks-long and in some ways months-long debate among city officials over this project. In September, the Planning Commission voted to deny the company's request for specifically two critical permits, which basically halted the project. But USD Clean Fuels, this Texas-based energy company that has been trying to build this biofuel depot, appealed the decision, which raised it to the city council. And the city council, I think it would be fair to say, appeared a little divided on the proposal when mm-hmm. they first heard about it when they first heard presentations on the project in October. This was something that they asked whether the company might be able to electrify parts of its infrastructure to use electric locomotives and electric trucks instead of using these diesel burning equipment to transport the fuel. But on Tuesday, when the company came back and brought some of those questions to the council again, the council ultimately decided that company executives had failed to prove that they were going to take meaningful steps to protect residents' health. I think here's what City Council member Luz Molina had to say, who represents West National City.
The West Side has done its share. We are not saying no to progress. We're just not wanting to be the price of it.
Well, making it pretty clear, Philip, you've talked about, some of the historical impacts here of pollution in this area, and bringing it back to the neighborhood where this facility was supposed to go. I mean, what were you hearing from residents in their response to, the buildup of this vote and what they had to say?
Yes. So residents are complaining already of respiratory issues. The area is also known to have some of the highest rates of asthma in the county, and also comparable across the state as well. So this is one of the reasons why the California Air Resources Board designated the neighborhood as a Portside Environmental Justice neighborhood. It's actually slated for programs to reduce emissions rather than promote programs to increase emissions. And so, right, we already have that health issue. So the program in National City has been basically how best to endorse businesses that are going to turn that around.
Corey, you spoke to longtime National City residents, in your reporting here. One of those opposed to the project was Margarita Garcia. Let's take a listen to what she told you.
Ya tenemos mucho tiempo que estamos tratando de limpiar la ciudad de tóxicos. Ya casi lo estamos logrando. Y luego ya nos viene otro peor. Pues no es justo.
Yeah, Margarita is a retired hairdresser. She was 82 when I spoke to her earlier this year. And for two decades now, she's been fighting to end pollution in her neighborhood. She's one of the residents who are members of the Environmental Health Coalition, which is a local environmental justice group that does a lot of work to push back against pollution in South Bay communities. And what Margarita was saying there is, we've been trying to clean the city of pollution for a long time. We're almost there, and then something worse comes along. It's, she says, it's not fair. And what Margarita was really getting at there is that in recent decades, city officials in National City have recognized that there has been this sort of process of approvals from the city council, greenlighting some of this infrastructure, greenlighting industrial businesses moving into the region, and some of the activities of the port. Some of this is out of control of local officials, but some of this is within their control as well. And so in the 2010s and even earlier, national city leaders started acknowledging the concerns that residents were raising and saying, okay, we're going to take steps to slowly try and press out some of the industrial businesses on the west side. We're going to take steps to limit the amount of heavy industry that can be moving in. And I think what to many people this proposal for a new fuel depot represented was a reversal on that promise if city officials moved forward with it. So that was what that was what I heard from Margarita. That was what I heard from the other residents that I spoke with. That's what I think was going through a lot of people's minds ahead of the decision.
And as you mentioned there, it's not just the city, it's not just national city involved here. You mentioned the port of San Diego has an important role to play. Philip, it's been kind of a long road, as you both have reported on, to get to this point. A lot of debate, environmental reviews. I mean, the company USD Clean Fuels went through, a process here. What changes did they make along the way?
Well, so there first were conversations about how to electrify, whether it was possible to electrify the truck fleet. I will mention that the Environmental Health Coalition has been collaborating on a project to potentially bring in a charging station for electric trucks in National City. So they are thinking about, the future of how to transform industry in the area. But that was not a possibility from the perspective of USD Clean Fuels, as they actually charter out those services. The truck drivers are not under their purview. So then it turned to what kind of mitigation efforts they could bring forth in these last couple of weeks. And they came back with a proposal basically to plant 1,000 trees and over the next 10 years and to bring in about 100 air filters to residences within the area of the proposed station. And well, that clearly was not enough from the perspective of the council to really bring this into the position of a zero emissions project.
Yeah, Corey, I mean, how did you see the community react to those plans that USD Clean Fuels put forth to kind of mitigate some of the concerns here?
Yeah, I would agree with what Philip said. I mean, I think there were a lot of people at the meeting on Tuesday who heard what the company had to say, heard some of the proposals that they brought back to make changes to the project, and didn't think it was enough. I mean, the company also sort of tried to make this point. Company executives tried to find ways to, I think, increase the efficiency of the project. Basically, one of the main arguments that they made was that some of the greatest emissions from the project, greatest diesel pollution, was going to come from trains, the locomotives. And so they tried to say that they would hitch the cars carrying their fuel into National City onto trains that would already be passing through instead of sending additional trains through the city. But I mean, to sort of the city council's, the questions that the city council raised back in October last month, they really didn't make very much of a mention of any kinds of electrification, any kind of commitments to electrify those locomotives or electrify the trucks that they were going to use. So I would say from what we heard on Tuesday, there was a big gap between some of what the council was asking for last month and what the company came back with.
So, Philip, I mean, the council's decision was a unanimous vote, right? I mean, is that the end of the road for this proposed project? What are you hearing there?
I mean, as of now, we can call it the end of a road. I mean, the company itself, USD Clean Fuels, has said that it's going to seek local and state pathways to consider what their future, what the possibilities are. But that, for now, is quite unclear.
Okay. Well, I want to finish up now just by getting your final thoughts. I mean, you both have covered this over many months. This is one project. You know, there's a lot around similar projects, as you mentioned, Philip. What questions do you have going forward for the story, Corey?
Yeah, I think to me, what this moment and this decision on Tuesday really represents is a real victory for environmental advocates at a time when there are not a whole lot of those to go around. I mean, I think that the project itself, there are many counties or many communities in San Diego County who I think would have been opposed to this project and opposed to living near it, near that kind of that level of pollution. But I think what made the fight against it in National City, especially why it stands out so much and why it drew so much attention, is because this is a neighborhood where this has been happening for decades, these same kinds of activities. And this is a city where one in four residents live below the federal poverty level. More than two-thirds of people identify as Latino. And this is really a place where, like many communities across the country, where pollution has been concentrated in a place where poor people and people of color live. And so I think that this decision was really a test of that, and it was a movement where and the environmental justice sort of advocates went out at a time where that's not really happening too much.
We'll have to leave it there for now, but hopefully we can speak more soon about where this goes. I've been speaking with Corey Suzuki. He covers San Diego South Bay for KPBS, along with Philip Salata. He's the environment and energy reporter with iNewsSource. Thanks for joining us and breaking this down for us today.
A pleasure.
Thank you, Andrew.
Coming up, the creators of the KPBS Arts podcast, The Finest, join us to share their reflections as they wrap up their first season. You're listening to KPBS Roundtable.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. You might recognize that sound. That's the theme music from our colleagues over at The Finest. It's the KPBS podcast all about the art and movements defining San Diego. And they're celebrating their season one finale this week. And in that season, they've covered stories on everything from matcha to indie music, from poetry to birding. And they're joining us here on Roundtable now to talk more about this first season. Julie Dixon Evans is KPBS arts reporter and host of The Finest. And also Anthony Wallace, he is the podcast producer. Welcome to both of you to the Roundtable.
Hey, Andrew. Thanks for having us.
Great to have you here and to talk about The Finest and really celebrate the achievement here. You have, 25 episodes
25.
Now? 25, yep. So the season one finale just came out Thursday. Congratulations on the season, but tell us about this finale. It's about the fight to read in America's prisons.
Yeah, so, I mean, this episode started working on it actually about a year ago, almost a full year ago. We wanted to do a news story. It started out as a news story about Books Through Bars, which is a San Diego prison books program. They ship books to people who are incarcerated across the country. So not just local jails, but everywhere. And we met somebody who is a volunteer with them who had actually had experience incarcerated. And her story was so incredible. And she was so willing to just go there and talk about her experience that we just knew we wanted to spend a little more time with her. And then, uncovering a ton of stuff about the way that prisons censor reading materials really, really steered that episode a lot.
Yeah, it was just my second week of work ever at KPBS. I just went with Julia to help her film the news package. It's doing something unfamiliar, working with a camera. Cherish, the person that we interviewed, the volunteer with Books Through Bars, was her personal story was just incredible. It was so captivating that we were okay, this can be something a lot bigger than just a news story. And the more we dug into it, the more interesting it became. It's very surprising how books are censored in prison. The kinds of books that they don't allow in are not necessarily the ones you would expect.
Well, let's take a listen to a little bit of that episode. We have a clip here.
It was during COVID, and so there were many months when we wouldn't leave our cells at all, except every other day to use a shower for 15 minutes, and that's it. We couldn't even go outside. Aside from that, we were sitting on our beds in the cells, and I only could do one of two things, either sleep or look out the window and watch the geese, because there was tons of geese at that prison.
But Cherish had one thing, one respite from the brutal monotony. Geese or not.
So really, the only brief escape we had were books. And I went through so many books. I think that's the only thing that allowed me to actually get through it.
One thing I love about this episode is it just really kind of illustrates your approach to arts and culture and really the wide breadth that you cover it with. I'm just curious, Julia, how did you approach, you know, framing what you wanted season one of The Finest to be? Because it covers such a wide variety here.
I mean, we had like a really long brainstorming process at the start of the season before we really dove into any other episodes. And we were talking about like where our stories are going to come from and what is going to be at the heart of this season and these episodes. And it's almost always about the people. I think if we can find somebody with a great story, that is the first priority, right? That is what then shapes, okay, what are the topics? Is this going to be about art? And we were really leaning into this kind of like the broad definition of culture. So it's not just art as you would think in the traditional sense, like books or visual art or theater, but it's more like identity and the way that, like, culture is your identity and it's your background, and it's kind of like the way that you exist in community and the relationships that you have. So you can go so many ways with culture.
And you did in this season, actually. One thing that comes to mind is the KPBS music series. This is something that you're involved with, bringing musicians here into KPBS and really changing the vibes here and bringing music alive. But it kind of goes to that community point, Julia. Can you talk about, I think, the first concert was this band Slacker. That's part of your first season, right?
Yeah, I mean, the music series is so fun because not only is it like a total treat for us in our workday, it's a way for us to have these like open concerts, or, you know, it's a pilot program, so we're not entirely sure how it will end up, but also this video series, a way to have an outlet for smaller, emerging local acts to get their music out there.
Yeah, and we had a... we had the show here at KPBS, like, during lunch. So, you know, everyone that worked here got to go out there and hang out, which is cool. But we also invited, like, students from the San Diego State campus to come. And so I think it was a cool way to, like, familiarize a lot of those kids with KPBS. You know, maybe they had walked by the building, but they'd never been inside. It was a lot of fun, and the band was very fun. And so, yeah, they performed, and then basically right after, we took them back here to the studio and talked to them just about the songs that they played and the story of their band. And we put together a little episode featuring that stuff.
And they were, I mean, what I loved about that band is how much they loved being in a band. And it's like, it's just great to hear sometimes that people are making art and loving the process of it. Like, I don't know. It was very rejuvenating for me as someone who'd been covering art for so long to just get this like really genuine, creative story.
There's nothing like the bond of a band.
Yeah. They're like besties. I loved it. Yeah.
I mean, it's like a family.
It's a real relationship. Yeah, absolutely. So, Julia, I hate to do this to you, but, you know, after these 25 episodes, after season one's in the books, I don't want to ask you, you know, for a favorite, because I imagine that's pretty hard to do, but do any episodes particularly resonate for you as you look back on season one?
I mean, a whole bunch, even just like a small little bunch of them really stick out to me, but I'm going to go with one of the most recent ones, which is... It was about this lost composer. Her name is Alice Barnett, and she lived in San Diego like 100 years ago. And she was quite popular. She was quite famous. She was known across the country. And then she passed away in like 1975. She mostly stopped composing in the 1930s, I think it was. And then like was lost from the discourse. Like people don't talk about her. People don't play her music anymore. And she was performed around the world, really. And we came across this woman who is a local musicologist, Katina Mitchell. And she is like, she discovered her when she was like researching her own house and found out that this composer lived across the street, used to live across the street. And so she went to the San Diego History Center and looked up archives, found musical scores, and then started finding all of these details that were kind of weirdly similar to her own life, like 100 years later. And it's just what I love about this story is how delightful both of these characters are. Like they're just a joy to listen to. And it also turned into this like exploration of fame. And like these are the big questions that like Anthony and I have when we are coming up with what will this episode be about? And when I pitched this one to Anthony, I knew that he would be like asking these big questions about like, okay, but why is someone forgotten? And yeah, I don't know if you want to speak to like, that process.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you're asking earlier, you know, how we choose episode topics or how, I think like, you know, most of our episodes have, or really all of them, have two components. You know, one is a great story about a local person. It's very compelling. And then the other is like some big idea, some very interesting big idea. And the example of this episode, the story is this woman who's like uncovering a lost musician. But then the big idea is like, how are famous people forgotten? And like, what determines like which famous people are remembered versus forgotten? So he posed the question of like, what famous musicians today will still be known in 100 years?
Andrew, what do you think? Which famous musicians are going to still be famous?
Are still going to be famous? Well, I think about this a lot in terms of certain music. I don't know, a band I love, I don't know, like New Order or just what sticks around and what doesn't. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting, and I don't know how you predict it, you know?
Right.
We have a clip from that episode, and again, this is about the composer Alice Barnett.
100 years ago, Alice Barnett was a big deal.
Her pieces were played on national radio. There are thousands of mentions of her in the newspapers, from the New York Times, Los Angeles, Minneapolis.
For the past few years, Katina has been immersed in Alice Barnett's world, because as successful as Alice was in her time, today,
most people still have never heard of Alice Barnett. and I'm little by little trying to change that.
And that's actually Katina singing. So she has not only like uncovered the like information, she is literally sharing Alice's music.
Yeah,
by performing it.
Because when an artist from the pre-recorded music era is forgotten, it's like there's literally no recordings of their music. Like if you want that music to exist again or to be heard at all, you have to go and find the sheet music and then get a bunch of people together and play it. Mm-hmm. And in this case, you know, for some music, she's working off of literal, like, handwritten, like, in faded notebooks from 100 years ago, trying to decipher it and stuff. So it was interesting.
Anthony, Julia talked about, you know, just the importance of having these rich characters in each episode. Mm-hmm. And like we just heard from, you know, Alice Barnett there. But there's another episode that stands out all about Lucky Wong. Talk to me about that one and what sticks out for you.
Perhaps he's the most memorable character from the whole season to me. I never got to meet him. He passed away before we started working on the story. But basically, this guy, Lucky, had this diner in North Park that he opened in 1975, selling like basic, cheap breakfast food. And he worked there 6 days a week for basically 50 years. And he worked there by himself. Like, he literally took the orders, cooked the food, brought it out, like, one-man show. And he was doing this into his late 80s. But what really made him special and the story special was the bonds that he built with his regulars over the years. And I mean, it's just so far beyond like, you know, a normal acquaintance of someone you would see. I mean, there was 200 people, over 200 people at the funeral. Most of them were customers from the diner. And so basically what we did for this episode is there was so many people that loved him. It was almost like overwhelming. Like we couldn't interview all of them. So we like put out a call on Reddit and we said, if you're interested, just send us a voice memo about your memories of Lucky and his diner. And we got so many of them. You know, I think we probably had like 4-5 hours of audio to work with, and we kind of like stitched it all together. And there are some incredible stories in there.
Well, let's take a listen to a little bit of that and what you heard about him.
He said he had swum all the way here from China, and that we needed to grow up strong like him.
When I told him that the food was delicious, he responded with, "My food's not good, you're just hungry."
He especially enjoyed chatting with kids and giving bacon to dogs.
My children always called him Uncle Lucky.
Everybody thought they were special to him. I don't know how he did it. It wasn't real obvious, but you knew he cared about you.
It's just, yeah, it's really beautiful to hear that impact that he had. I want to call attention to another piece of that, and that's the music in the background. Mm-hmm. And this is something that jumps out to me about the episodes. And Anthony, I know you're humble about talking about this, but it's not like you guys just pick tracks, you know, out of thin air and just play them. This music you composed yourself. Tell us about the process and how you look to handle music in each particular episode here.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like come from a music background. I played in bands and made music, all throughout my 20s. And that's kind of like what got me into podcasting. I got interested in journalism and it was like, oh, I can like kind of make, you know, songs out of, you know, stories, you know, with podcasts. And the podcasts that really podcasts that really influenced me and made me love podcasts are like Radiolab, and shows like that are very sound rich. For me, it's a lot of fun to add a lot of music and sound and kind of, you know, make it feel like you're in a, you know, it's like sucked into a particular world when you're listening to something.
Another part of the podcast that stands out to me, Julia, and I'm wondering if you can tell us more about it, is just it seems that you both work so well together in creating this podcast. Is, you know, I'm wondering how you collaborate. What's your process for making an episode for The Finest?
I mean, yeah, it's like incredible to be able to have a great team. And Chrissy Nguyen, our editor, is a big part of that too. I think what I like about working with Anthony and Chrissy is like the way that we can develop an idea and like bring something that we have our own perspective on, and then like get questions and curiosity that we may not otherwise have thought of. And I think I have learned a lot about the podcast interview style. I think in the broadcast world, you're probably familiar, you'll probably relate to this, is like when you're interviewing someone, you're thinking of like brevity, you're trying to get the sound bite. But when you're putting together a story, like a long form story, the interview just can go on for hours. Mm-hmm. We really dig in, and sometimes you think you have the full story, but Anthony will like come in my ear and be like, let's ask again about this one thing and get more. And it's been really great to learn, you know, more about really getting that story and like the full breadth of storytelling.
And on that full breadth, I mean, one episode that stands out to me is you told the story of local musician Juliana Zachariou and the economic realities of being a musician today in this streaming era. And Anthony, I love it. I think you both started the episode out by just going out and asking people on the street, you know, if you got 5 million listens on Spotify, how much do you think you would make? Without giving too much away, just tell us, how far off were they?
They were way off. Yeah, almost everyone way underestimated. And that's what we were anticipating.
No, overestimated, right? They thought that people would be rolling in the dough if they had a hit on Spotify.
Yeah, people were way off. They thought that you'd make way more money than you really do. And that's what we anticipated. Uh-huh.
And so Juliana Zachariou, she actually had a song, right, Julia, that got 5 million plus plays on Spotify.
Right. And I mean, I love that song and I've loved it for years. And so to talk to her about that, this actual experience of, you know, you think you're making it as a musician and you're not, and the struggles. And it's anchored in the song that, like, I myself have listened to like dozens of times. So,
what was the math there?
I'm not the math person in this collaboration.
But Anthony, do you remember how much she ended up making? Because you guys actually sit down.
$15,000.
That's right. I was struggling to remember, but that's right. Yeah,
right?
She made $15,000.
Over 7 years.
And Julie, you talked to her and she kind of reflected on that. Mm-hmm. We have a clip from that episode.
Honestly, doing that math in front of you just makes me so angry and emotional. I think that's why I don't engage with it too often, because it's so heartbreaking. And I had the luck of getting one song into those numbers. It's really hard to get those numbers. It's the shooting star kind of thing.
And, you know, I have known Juliana Zachariou for a couple of years professionally. Like, I have interviewed her before, and like a year and a half ago. So before we had started this podcast, before we started interviewing her for this episode, I sat down with her for a couple hours. We had coffee and I taped it. And I just wanted to see if she would go there, if she would be willing to talk about finances, because you need somebody who's willing to, you know, lay out the numbers to really understand how dire the music economy is for artists. And so, like, I, even in that moment when we were in the studio, I didn't know what, I still wasn't sure, like, how far she would go, if she would give us, like, the numbers. And it, like, we both choked up during that interview.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty striking, pretty powerful. Julia, you've obviously covered San Diego's art scene for several years. You know, after working on The Finest this season, what trends are you seeing in San Diego's art scene?
I mean, I think I have, like, a more, not to overuse the word dire, but a more dire sense of, like, how much artists are struggling. I also, though, have a lot more hope. I think I have the sense that people are talking, they're building community, they are finding ways to share what they're creating, whether it's food, whether it's, you know, art spaces, whether it's music. And I think that just, like, seeing that more, I'm thinking of the graffiti episode too, like, just seeing the way that people are, you know, putting art as this like priority in their lives is really, that's giving me hope despite everything else.
Anthony, I mean, you guys were done with season one here. I don't want to put you too much on the spot, but you do have another season coming fairly soon. What can you tell us about season two? And I don't know, more importantly, what stories are you looking forward to telling next year on The Finest?
Yeah, I mean, we have probably about like 50 ideas for episodes. So we're overflowing with them. We have no shortage of those. You know, one of the upcoming episodes that we're excited about is about risograph printing, which is like this kind of, it's sometimes called like digital screen printing. It's kind of hard to describe, but it has a particular look to it. There's a limited number of colors. It's like the colors are vivid, but the history of it is very interesting. It started like in Japan post-World War II out of, like, resource constraints. But basically, it was just, like, this cheap way to make flyers for businesses and churches and stuff, like, in the 80s. But it became obsolete, and all these machines got thrown away. And
or just, like, collecting dust
in a basement or something.
Church basements, yeah.
But there's been a movement recently of artists finding these machines in basements and stuff and making art out of them. And so our episode will trace that whole history.
Anchored in a local press, Bernal Books, who they have had a couple of risograph printers. I think they have more than one now. But for a while, they had one that was like the only one in the area.
Well, something for folks to look forward to, but still, for anyone, you can catch up on all the episodes from the first season of The Finest at kpbs.org/podcasts or really wherever you listen to your podcasts. I've been speaking with Julia Dixon Evans. She's host of The Finest and the podcast producer, Anthony Wallace. I want to thank you both for being here on Roundtable.
Hey, thank you, Andrew.
That'll do it for the KPBS Roundtable today. Thanks so much for listening. You can always find the show anytime as a podcast or leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. KPBS Roundtable airs on KPBS FM at noon on Fridays, again, Sundays at 6 a.m. If you have any thoughts on today's show, you can email us at roundtable@kpbs.org or leave us a message at 619-452-0228. Roundtable's technical producers this week were Brandon Trufa and Rebecca Chacon. The show was produced by Ashley Rush. Brooke Ruth is Roundtable's senior producer. I'm your host, Andrew Bracken. Thanks again for listening, and have a great weekend.
Figuring out the right sport for your kid can feel overwhelming. I'm taking that journey with my son, Dorian, exploring different sports and revisiting the fields that I grew up playing. Together, we're searching for the right fit and maybe reconnecting with a few old memories along the way. It's Game Time Decision, a new series from KPBS. Join us at kpbs.org/gametime.